Paul.
Nice.
Welcome to Crack House.
Thank you. I've been waiting. This is awesome.
Yes, this is my room in the Crack House that I've cleaned. Ignore the smell. Most of my previous guests have been kind enough not to comment about the smell.
I've already urinated on the floor.
Thank you. Well, you're right at home. Please sit down, have some salami, and take a breather.
Oh,
okay. Well, it's okay.
Good.
I happen to have another bag of salami behind the chair you're sitting in. Just for you. I always keep an extra salami. At least that's what I tell the ladies.
Oh. I love to talk about alchemy over some nice, warm salami.
Well, there you go. You just alluded to my attempt at a segue. Today, I brought you on because I did an episode with Paz about alchemy in politics. And you messaged me and you were like, we got to talk about practical alchemy. And I was sold from the start because I'm very into the idea of practical alchemy, but I don't know where to start. So we resolved that we would do an episode on what practical alchemy is and who's doing it. So probably you could take us from where you want to go with this, but what, first of all, is your personal experience with it? And then I guess you could talk about the history of where it begins.
Well, my history with alchemy probably starts when I was in high school, and I just started reading a bunch of books on it because it fascinated me. I was like, okay, so these are the guys who created chemistry. These are the guys who created physics. Mm-hmm. They came up with all this stuff. And you were right before when you were talking about the guy who came up with Newtonian physics. He was also an alchemist. He translated
really?
A lot of alchemical stuff. Yeah, that was his contribution.
Yeah.
Okay. Isaac Newton, yeah. And he was also really into planets and astrology. And that's because all alchemy is directly related to planets and astrology. So since we're talking about practical alchemy, we got to go back to the beginning. And the beginning is what the alchemist would call following the path of nature, right? And so the path of nature is looking out your window, figuring out how these plants are growing and multiplying, because that's where all alchemists start, is plant alchemy, making what are called spagyrics. It's a weird word. Yeah, spagyrics. Now what
spagyrics.
They're doing,
I like
yeah,
that.
Yeah. Spagyria is the first realm of alchemy. Before you go into anything about minerals, you have to know about the plants. Interesting story. Plant, the word, comes from the word planet. So every plant is governed or strengthened by the energies of these different planets. And the alchemists discovered these associations by their color, by their taste, by these all the different aspects of them, right? And the first and primary thing that the alchemists were interested in is not the four elements, but the three elements, right? Okay. Now in Western everything, you're always going to find the three elements of the thing. You've got, you know, problem, reaction, solution, if you're talking about the Hegelian dialectic, right? But that goes all the way back to ancient Greece. And they're always talking about the triune, the trivium, right? Because this is at the heart of Western everything. And so they use the idea of the trivium in the case of alchemy. It's salt, sulfur, and mercury. Now, they're not talking about literal salt, literal sulfur, and literal mercury. What they're talking about is the basic essence of these things. So, for instance, the salt of a thing would be the body. Boiled down, the basic makeup, the salt of a human would be the carbon, right? It's the building block that everything else is built off of, right? So in plant alchemy, the salt is what you get when you've completely burned the plant to ashes. And then you keep roasting those ashes until what you have left over is the whitest white stuff of the thing, right? And what you do with that is you put it through several filtration processes to get the salt of the ashes that are left over. That's the calcination process. Now, once you have that salt, you're trying to rebuild the body. So the alchemist had the saying, solve et coagula, which means that you have to break something apart, solve, and then coagula, bring it all back together. So the idea of plant alchemy, spagyria, was they got the most basic elements from all plants, boiled it down to its most basic components, and then recombined them. So the salt would be one of those.
So like, and, just to stop you there, so like you're the earliest of the alchemists that would have been working with plants for like first and foremost.
Yeah, I think all of them, like you have to start on the plant so that you can learn to the next step.
Okay.
You understand? So
yeah,
everybody has to start on plants, and plant medicine is what they were trying to create by doing this stuff. So if a, let's say a Jupiter plant, right? Something that is about livers and yellow and these different colors, you would you know, break them down, you would take a whole bunch of it. Now the different parts of the plant are important too. So if based off of where you're trying to treat in the body, you're going to use the roots, the leaves, or the flowers, right?
Okay, yeah.
And then you go through the process. Now this is also the basis for what's that called, it's where you have a small part of it, a part of a medicine, and you're taking it, and all the atheists get really pissed off when you mention homeopathy.
Homeopathy, right? Okay. What is that?
Yeah, so homeopathy is similar, where you're just taking what they would consider, the homeopaths would consider, the most basic vibrational element of a thing. So they would dilute something, you know, hundreds of times, like let's say snake venom. They dilute it hundreds of times to where there's like a part per billion of snake venom in this little vial of like mostly water.
All right.
And then you drink that, and then supposedly you've ingested the energy of the thing. Well, okay. In a lot of ways, spagyria is like that too. What you're trying to do is you're trying to get to the most basic elements of the thing so that the information passes on spiritually to the subject or the patient.
Okay, I see. All right. So that's, is that, yeah, salt, right. And then there's mercury and.
Yes. And the mercury of plants, see, the mercury is different in all different kingdoms, right? This is where you get the idea of kingdoms from. So you've got the plant kingdom, you've got the animal kingdom, you've got the mineral kingdom. So in the plant kingdom, the mercury of a thing is the alcohol, because every plant, when you add a couple of sugars and you add some yeast, gives you alcohol. So the sugars of the plant can be made into an alcohol, and all plants have sugar somewhere in them, right? So that's the universal solvent. Mercury is the solvent in spirit.
So mercury is thought of as the thing that you can get in every one of these kingdoms. There you can derive the same substance from it.
Right. So the spirits of the plant are then passed over the salt and the sulfur. And the sulfur is interesting because all plants also have a type of volatile substance, right? And this volatile substance is always being evaporated. You can smell it. These are the oils, the essential oils of the plant. So you've got your three elements now, the salt, sulfur, and mercury, and you can process them to create a medicine called the spagyria. Or a spagyric.
Okay. So wait, before you continue, let me go back. Hold on. So the mercury is, talk about it in more esoteric terms. I'm trying to understand how to think about it as far as in the greater scheme of things. The mercury is a spirit, like it's the spirit of the thing.
That's where you get the term spirits from. It's the alcohol derived from a plant. Right,
but now we're just talking about plants here,
just plants. But at the same time, the spirit is something to be found in everything. So you can find the spirit of a metal, a spirit. So all of these other things start to come into greater and greater focus when you expand out into other kingdoms. The animal kingdom has a different spirit.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay. So for plants, the spirit is alcohol that you can derive from the sugar. But for animals, it's something else. It could be something different.
Right. But what the alchemists are looking at is the similarities.
Yes.
So they're going to find the spirit that is similar in behavior and process as the plant kingdom.
Okay.
So once you've found that and you've derived some knowledge from it, you can work with it.
Okay. Got it. And then sulfur is a volatile, that now how do you get the sulfur of a plant? What does that mean, the volatile aspect of a plant?
Well, in the case of plants, it's all about the essential oils or the scent of the thing, right? You can take plants and put them in a steamer, right? And steam it up, and you know how oil reacts with water, it's sitting on top of it. So as you're circulating the steam on top of the plants, you're starting to collect the essential oils on top of the water underneath, right? Because that water is carrying. Now, if you do the same thing with alcohol, you get even more, which is why the spirit moves through the plant and takes with it the oils, because you can combine oil and alcohol almost indefinitely, right? And it only takes, you know, 78 degrees to separate that alcohol and the oil. So once you evaporate out the spirit, then you're left with the soul or the sulfur. Now this salt, sulfur, and mercury applies to every human body, right?
So human body, everybody.
Right. Human body, everybody. So this is where the ideas of, you know, transmutation comes from. Because if you can break things down to its essential constituent parts, you can put it back together in a different order and create something new.
Okay.
Right. So a lot of times they'll talk about things in very verbose and dramatic ways. Like if you ever read The Alchemical Wedding or The Emerald Tablet of Hermes Trismegistus, these writings are done in a way that only the people who have started down this path can really start to grasp and see examples of it, because it's just too verbose for a person who has no experience with chemistry to understand. And this was the elitist part. You guys were talking about that on the last episode, how it was only the rich and the elite people in society who would practice alchemy, and their writings would actually carry that forward into other things, because there was no lay alchemist. There was always, you know, you're a part of this kingdom, or you're a part of this court, and you're doing the alchemical work for this king. And you see that reflected a lot in their writings too, because everything is part of a kingdom.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. This is that, is Hermes Trismegistus the guy who does comes up with the axiom as above, so below? I guess we'll get more to him later, but I'm curious, because I'm hearing a lot of as above, so below type of ideas.
Right. That's exactly what it is. That Hermes is the Greek god of communication. Right. Now, Hermes was combined with the Egyptian god Thoth in the Alexandria period. Right. So the Alexandria period, where they've got this great library, they started away from the classical gods and goddesses, and they started focusing almost entirely on Thoth Hermes, and they created a system of magic and understanding of the universe called Hermeticism. And Hermeticism was really a blend of Gnosticism, Christianity, and a lot of the writers of the day included as much Christianity as possible so that they wouldn't get burned, you know, like you've got this guy named, let me see. Oh, I just had his name. Give me a second.
Yep.
Paracelsus von Hohenheim, right? And in his writings about alchemy, every other sentence is by the grace of God. So he's talking about animals and spirits and all of these nature elements that would get you burned at the stake. Sure. But he's saying, but by the grace of God,
like that
we do this
guy,
and this and
that
this.
Guy, that Vietnam veteran who like blinked out hostage.
Right.
it's okay, everybody. I'm one of you. He's blinking rapidly.
Right. Okay. And he was, I think, one of the first people to put into writing the idea of the sylphs, the salamanders, and the undines. And if you know anything about
nature,
He's the guy who came up with that sort of system. And he was talking about these spirits as if you could just go out and touch them, you know. I think in a lot of ways we've kind of cut ourselves off from the ability to sense and speak to spirits in such a way, because I think there is something to the idea that nature has intelligences all its own. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah, no doubt. Yeah, no doubt. Go out into the wilderness. And I think that's pretty evident.
That's sort of what I discovered with the whole alchemy thing is, if you pay attention, you can start to see these patterns, you know, and these patterns are sort of, I know you don't like him, but the guy who was Freud's mentee, who always talks about archetypes. No, archetypes.
Oh, Jung.
Yeah, Carl Jung. He took all the alchemy literature and boiled it down into his archetype ideas, right? He's saying, these are repeating patterns. Yeah, he was huge into alchemy. So Carl Jung did that because he thought, you know, I don't think this is the complete list of things that you can, you know, see repeating in human, you know, storytelling and things like that. But this is a list. These things are present over and over and over again. And then you've got people like Joseph Campbell who write Once in the Future Myth based off of Carl Jung. And he actually creates, you know, a system of writing that is, all writing applies to the arc, you know, the narrative arc. You know, everything fits into it. And that all comes out of alchemy. So the modern alchemists are the storytellers today. And all they're doing is they're going by this formula to turn everyday events into something that is, you know, valuable to more people, you know, or imaginative events.
So I wonder then, before we get onto the people who did it, one of the questions I have is, all this stuff seems very clearly like it was, if it in some way leads to chemistry, all of the discoveries that were made were empirical discoveries. This is not philosophical, right? The alchemists learned that these patterns existed in nature over time. This isn't a rational exercise, right?
Well, as you put it before, this is more about qualitative in terms of, than quantitative. Chemistry would be quantitative alchemy.
Okay.
You understand what I mean?
Yes, I do. Yes. So you're talking about the essences of the, rather than the quantities or the interactions of the things, you're talking about the technology of it, what the purpose of a thing is, stuff like that.
More metaphysical. In terms of the greater universe, right?
Yeah. What is the greater purpose of this material?
Right. Chemistry is the microcosm. Right. That's what you get when you're just looking at the quantities.
Okay.
Right. And then in the macrocosm, you start to see the oddities. Right. Like if you read any plant alchemy books, they're going to start you off saying you need a basis in chemistry. You need to know this stuff because it's going to be very important when it comes time to start seeing these changes in your flask that chemistry can't explain.
So, Ball, then. So you're saying that chemistry and alchemy develop parallel to one another throughout history, not that chemistry comes after?
Right. Alchemists were chemists, right? Anybody who's saying, this was just pre-chemistry, that's crap. These guys had very deep scientific understanding of the materials that they were working with. But what they had their eye on were the oddities. And that's something you can't say about a lot of people today, especially in the field of science. They don't really give a shit about the outliers. All they want to talk about is the uniform shit, right? Because the uniform shit makes better building blocks than the outliers. The outliers get people fired.
Yeah, no doubt.
So
I
found out the other day that there have been over 11,000 patents seized by the United States government.
Why?
We don't know, but we do know that the government knew enough to steal them from whoever started it.
Yeah,
outright theft.
And what were they? What kinds of things that were stolen?
Well, we would know that if we had a transparent government, right? But the whole reason why they stole it in the first place is so that nobody else could have it.
Yep. Yeah, that's why I want to know what they took. That's exactly what I want to know. what they took, because the only reason they're taking it is because they want it more than they know we should shouldn't have it.
Right. So these are the problems that I think, you know, a lot of alchemists could be working on today, because they're concerned with the outliers.
So the idea that to me, an alchemist, or one of the pursuits of alchemy, was in the specific turn a coal to gold, or turn some material that isn't gold into gold. That's the specific. And then the more generally, find out what the transmutative process is. Is that about right? So then I would ask you. Yeah, go ahead.
The royalty was concerned with lead into gold. The alchemists themselves were involved in, how do I understand nature deeper?
That's a really interesting way of putting it, is that the pursuit of the alchemists doing the transmutating isn't, we want lots of gold and money. It will use the need for gold from the royals so that they can fund and protect us while we figure out how to transmute other things.
Right.
So then I would ask,
most highly educated.
When I usually think of turning something into gold, that's called alchemy, right? But I'm trying to figure out, like,
called atomic physics, because what they're able to do now is using fusion and using massive alpha wave particles, they can turn one atom into another, but you're not going to get very much out of it, right? So they can already turn lead into gold. All you got to do is bombard it with, you know, more protons to change the nucleus.
Right. Well, dude, physics is what it was always all about, for sure.
But
it was always about changing the strings of reality specifically.
Right. Well, in physics, what they're trying to do is to do it uniformly. They're trying to take humans out of the equation. Right. Because, as you know, with quantum physics, you know, humans are in the equation. What we observe changes the outcome.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. So there is that human element. And for some reason, science doesn't like that, because it doesn't give them a uniform picture of reality.
Yeah, on this show, why there is no quantum physics.
You do? I don't. I think it's all fake.
I'm willing to say all of it is fake, but I do have a preference.
Right.
I definitely have a preference. So wait, anyway, before I get off track, because I keep trying to ask, but I don't know how to get to this point of asking. The other thing that alchemists did was make medicines. Now, I'm curious about what some of those medicines were and how that's not chemistry, or is it chemistry, but alchemists were concerned with the alchemical part while doing the chemical part? So what are some medicines, and what was their concern with making medicines?
This is why we got to go back to Paracelsus von Hohenheim, or Paracelsus Bombastus, Theophrastus von Hohenheim. That was his full name.
God, Jesus.
Wait
a minute. Before you do that, let's give it a good Google and try that again. What's para? Celsius.
Paracelsus.
Right? Okay. Paracelsus. Yeah. His birth name was, his full birth name was Philippus Aurelius Theophrastus Bombastus von Hohenheim, also known as Paracelsus. Now, where can we get names like that?
Switzerland.
Okay,
Switzerland. This is before Switzerland even existed. All right. It was just Warring Kingdoms.
It may still not exist, frankly.
Yeah. No, frankly, it really doesn't. And the people who live there haven't really realized that yet. But
we have no, anytime they have a vote, no Swiss listeners who aren't on VPNs.
Wow.
So, yeah. So,
but we do have Swiss listeners, right? I know Ann Katz over there.
Oh, are you sure?
Yeah.
Are you sure? Have you met
him? Yeah, one of them. Yes. Well, he was online, but he specifically went to Marx's grave and sent us a picture of him pissing on Marx's grave, which is great.
Where's Marx's grave? Is it in, not in Switzerland?
It's in England.
It's in England.
It is. Yeah, he sent us messages at Anarchy Ball. He's like, I'm going to Marx's grave and pissing on it. I'm going to send you guys the pictures. He did.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah. Shout out to you. Damn. All right. Let me not distract us from Philippus Aurelius Theophrastus Bombastus von Hohenheim. Please tell me everything you know about him.
So this guy is the father of pharmacology, which is what we use today to create medicines. All right. So his great contribution was saying, It's the dose that makes the poison. So he was treating goiters and shit with mercury salts before anybody else would even touch it, because they just knew of mercury as being this, you know, incredibly poisonous shit. Mm-hmm. So he made his medical assessment based off of astrology and figured out that mercury could treat goiters if it was given in the right amounts. And his big contribution to medical science was saying, it's the dose that makes the poison.
I like
which
that.
Is very important, right? Yeah. And this guy also talked about creating homunculi.
Oh,
homunculi.
Hell yeah. I play Dungeons and Dragons. I know what those little freaks are.
Oh yeah, dude. You can still look up his formula for making a homunculus in a flask using manure, right? To keep it nice and warm.
Oh, God.
And
okay. Well, wait, explain what a homunculus is. Yeah.
A lot of people think it's a created human, right? It's a human in a flask. That's the way they call it. But
what
you're doing is
you're
right. But it can apply to anything. You can make a homunculus of a tree. You can make a homunculus of a dog. The idea is you're taking the essence of the thing and you're growing it spiritually inside of a flask so that the spiritual essence will manifest for you in it.
So it doesn't literally mean that you would create a tiny human in a jar, but that you'd be able to collect the spirit of a human in a jar, kind of?
Or create a soul in a jar.
A soul, but I'm saying it's not a physical, you're not going to have a tiny man in there.
He talked something about that, but in terms of his formula, it's not going to create a man.
Tiny man, okay.
Right, so, I mean, I think what he was seeing might have been, you know, some sort of spiritual hallucination or whatever. But, you know, okay, if you're creating a soul in a jar, I think that's pretty valuable.
I think that's pretty crazy. I think that's pretty wild if that's what he's doing. So the homunculus in the jar, what do you do with it? Well, what kinds of homunculi were being created?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, he's not going to talk too much about what he actually did with this stuff because he wanted to avoid the pyre.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he was not popular with the medical elites of the time, and he would let them know as many times as he could he was not a fan of doctors because they were all a bunch of morons and he was the only genius around them. And eventually people figured that either the doctors had pushed him off a cliff or he had jumped himself, but he died early. And at his gravesite, people still go there because they claim healing properties at his gravesite.
Hmm.
Kind of interesting. But he's one of many of these men in history, another one being the algebra guy. Wow. Why am I so blanking on their names?
Algebra guy.
Yeah, algebra, the guy who created
from
the
where? Arabic guy,
the theorem. Now, Greece.
Algebra. Oh, Pythagoras? You talking about no, geometry? That's geometry, though. I'm pretty sure.
Okay, yeah, you're right. It's geometry, right?
Man, I know a lot about Pythagoras. I know a whole lot about him.
He was said to be able to transmute his leg into gold. His leg.
Yeah.
I'm not sure why.
Yeah. He didn't eat. Did you know this? He didn't eat beans when he was a baby. He was kidnapped by Buddhists. And when he grew up, his two parents starved themselves to death for fun.
Wow.
Like they did it. They wanted to. And he was like,
the very first
guys.
Breatharians.
Yeah. Mm-hmm, yeah. So they were pretty buck wild. The early ones, they wouldn't eat beans and they never explained why. They just avoided eating beans.
Well, Breatharians claim to be alchemists too. I mean, like alchemy is not something that is just solely in Europe, right?
It seems like a tendency in like the same way that rhetoric is a tendency, like where you want to persuade people. That's not a thing that came out of Greece. Every human being ever has tried to use rhetoric. Yeah, I'm into that. I get that. Okay.
And there's,
so
there's Chinese medicine, which could be considered alchemy because of some of the properties of the things that they try to create. And then you've got Indian, which is, I forgot what it's called, but there's Indian alchemy as well. And you can, you know, look up Indian alchemy and you'll find all this stuff. And there's so many crossovers, right? So the basic elements in all of these things match up with each other. And, you know, it's hard to believe that they would be able to, you know, communicate over these many centuries and distances. They had to be discovering something about the spiritual nature of stuff.
Yep. Yeah. Right? No doubt. 100%. So now maybe we do some other than Paracelsus. I think I got that right, actually. Give me some other.
The thing about his name. His name is it's putting the guy named Celsus, the Greek guy named Celsus, in a ditch, because what he's saying is, I'm better than Celsus, Paracelsus.
Oh, I see.
That's fucking crazy. His name is a put down to somebody else.
Well, that would be like, there's a lot of, they have a lot of weird names. Like, they would all take weird, like a pseudo Dionysus is another one. It's like, why would you want to be named fake Dionysus? That doesn't make any sense to me. I don't get that. But yeah, they would all do stuff like that.
Purpose has been lost. I mean, what's the purpose in our names? What's the purpose in calling somebody Derek?
Well, right. Or, and that's true. And Hebrew name styles make a lot of sense when you realize that any utterance of Yah in any way was just meant to protect you. It was literally meant, they believed that if you uttered that name, it would be a protective spell. That's why they named their kids Jacob and Jesus, and all those things come out of that. So no doubt, the utterance of words is lost. The power of words is absolutely lost to us. No doubt.
Right. And I think if you study the ways of nature and the ways of alchemy, you start to understand language better, right? Because you have to study things like Greek, you have to study things like Hebrew, you have to see where these things come from. And then it all sort of transforms in your mind to understanding even, you know, direct communication is nothing but a wave of energy, right? It's a wave of energy and a sea of energy. And all these waves are moving things around, you know, through persuasion and through other means, but basically that's it. I mean, we're all just energy creatures in animal bodies.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah. I'm into it. It's a good thing. And I would like to now ask about the name that you used before that I'd like to get more into, Hermes Trismegistus. Can you tell me some things about him, where he comes from, what his contributions are?
Well, Hermes, the thrice glorified, is widely considered to be a fictional figure that had studied in Egypt and created the secret of transmutation. Right. Oh. And his work is called the Emerald Tablet. Now, a lot of people have said there's a lot more to the Emerald Tablet than just, you know, the basic screed, which I can read to you in a second. But the Emerald Tablet is like the basic processes of nature to get from point A to point B through transmutation.
Okay.
And he did this. He was very influenced by the Hermeticism of Egypt. And that says a lot, because that the whole Hermetic idea, it has a lot more to do with how the processes of the universe work, right? So it's been boiled down into the seven Hermetic principles, and I'll read those to you in just a minute. But
that's the Emerald Tablet, contains these seven principles, or that's something else?
It contains the seven principles in sort of coded language.
Oh, so this is derived from the tablet. This is what to get out of it. Cleaner.
Right.
Language. Okay.
So let me see if I can read it for you. The text. It is true without a lie, certain and absolute. I used to have it memorized, but my browser's taking a long time. Well, this is the tablet of Hermes Trismegistus, the Hermes Trice Glorified. It says, 'Tis true without lying, certain and most true. That which is below is like that which is above. That which is above is like that which is below, to do the miracles of only one thing. As all things have been, arose from one by the meditation of one, so all things have their birth from this one thing by adaption. The sun is its father, the moon is its mother, the wind hath carried it in its belly, the earth is its nurse. The father of all perfection in the whole world is here. It is its force or power is entire, if it be converted into earth. Separate thou from the earth the fire, the subtle from the gross, sweetly with great industry. It ascends from the earth to the heaven and again descends to the earth and receives the force of things superior and inferior. By this means, you shall have the glory of the whole world, and thereby all obscurity shall flee from you. Its force is above all force, for it vanquishes every subtle thing and penetrates every solid thing. So was the world created. From this are and do come admirable adaptations, whereof the means or process is here in this. Hence I am called Hermes Trismegistus, having the three parts of the philosophy of the whole world. That which I have said in the operation of the sun is accomplished and ended.
I feel like I got some of that. Yeah, if I
let me see
if I feel like I did. That somewhere in there, it sounded like he was saying the principle of what we want to do is break things and separate them by categories. I heard that somewhere when he said separate the subtle from the gross. Now, I don't know what those terms mean to him.
Well, that they would be the qualities of the thing, right? So a subtle thing would be like a vapor. A gross thing would be like a piece of wood. So dense and...
So I have a question right away then, because there's something in that it implies, first of all, this is it's a subjective approach. You have to try things to see, right? Someone goes, that is a gross aspect, that is a subtle aspect. If it doesn't work, then you have to adjust what you think is gross or subtle, correct?
Right.
So in a way, that implies
you would
that...
have to have principles, right? To understand these things.
Hold on, wait. I want to finish that thought because I'm really trying to think this out. In the way that implies it, to take a gross and a subtle, you could decide at first what you think those two things are. But if you take the gross and the subtle out and they don't yield the results you think they do, then you may have to readjust your evaluation of a thing's grossness or subtleness, right? If that's the case, alchemy is saying that there is an objective evaluation of something and you have to try it out enough times to figure out what that is. Is that correct?
Right. Well, so the alchemist assessment would be that everything has all the parts of the universe, sort of like a holographic idea. Everything has all the parts of the universe within it in different amounts.
I see. Okay.
Right. So everything has a subtle part to it, but it's in a different amount than the gross part. Right. So even vapor would have a gross part. And right. So it's all just the amounts.
But this is objective, is what I find really interesting, is it is the amount, but also it is the statement that everything has this in it and a certain amount in it.
Right.
Okay. Very interesting. Like so it is scientific then. This is, you cannot deny that this is scientific.
Right. Well, you can if you're, you know, on one of these.
Yeah, dummy. Yeah. But
Dawkins forums, right?
Yeah, sure. Right.
They love shitting all over alchemy and have absolutely nothing to say when it comes to people like Hermes Trismegistus talking about as above, so below. That's just not what they're into. Right. So later on in the early 1900s, maybe late 1800s, you have the principles of Hermeticism being codified into the Hermetic principles of the Kybalion. Now, do you know anything about the Kabbalah tree?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, Kabbalah. Yeah, medieval Kabbalah, right?
Right. Well, in medieval Kabbalah, they take the Jewish system. And they're like, well, this thing works. We're going to use it. And so they apply Greek principles to it because that's, you know, Greek and Latin are much more popular in Europe than, you know, the Jewish tradition. And even today, like if you look at the Washington Monument, the Washington Monument is in the middle of a Kabbalah tree, a partial Kabbalah tree in DC.
Yes, it is.
They just put it right there in the street work.
Yes. Now, so now do you think that that's because, like, and it certainly isn't the case today, because I know a whole lot of architects and city planners today. Certainly Robert Moses was somebody who's very well known in New York, and he was not a hermeticist at all. He was just a weird, gross eugenicist. But would you say that that reason why the Capitol is built that way is because certainly during that period of time, city planners and architects were all high society and in these...
Well, the Freemasons have a lot of hermetic aspects. That's basically what I was asking.
This is not a global conspiracy. It just makes sense that these Freemason guys who were into looking at the whole world as a process would probably build a city in a processional form.
Well, the Freemasons also believed that America was the new Atlantis.
Well, hell yeah.
Right? I mean, before... Well, that's not really a good thing, because look at the levers of power that they've included in their system to make you believe that it's, you know, a good thing when it's really not. You know, I did a program a while ago talking about Diana in Washington, D.C. Even D.C., like, what is a Columbia? Do you know what a Columbia is?
No.
Because back then, it was just the feminized version of Columbus. And why the fuck are they feminizing Columbus?
Yeah, indeed, why?
It all goes back to Diana worship, right? Diana worship and mock human sacrifices that they're doing at the White House and at the Capitol building.
Yeah, it's very interesting, because there's, I don't know, man, I'm around a lot of nerds and weirdos, right? And when you find a system, and you find a system that you believe is applicable to your life, makes sense, and you can use it constantly, you probably do everything while consulting that system. There's nothing wrong with that. I mean, maybe there is, but it depends on the system, I'm sure. But it just makes sense to me that if all these guys, Freemasons, whatever the case may be, back in the day, were all like into this stuff. They were all into alchemy, and it had promise, and it would make sense that there were so many symbolic representations around. So now what I guess I'm asking is DC built that way for symbolic purposes, or is DC built that way for like evocative purposes? Like, is there a deeper reason why it's built that way? Like, I don't know how to describe it. Do you know what I'm asking?
I do. I think what you're saying is, does it work?
Yes. Does it function as a tool, like ley lines or like the Nazca lines? Is there a functional purpose to it?
Well, that's an interesting thing. Like, have you ever seen the oh shit, what was it called? I think it was called The Key. It was an older movie about voodoo.
No.
Right. And in this movie about voodoo, this white woman comes into this world of voodoo and witchcraft, right? And the very first thing they say is, if you don't believe it, it can't affect you. But if you start to believe it, you will be affected by it, and there's no way to escape it.
Oh, yeah.
That's sort of what I see in terms of the magic and ritual going on in D.C. It's all a cult of state. I mean, the Romans kind of perfected the cult of state, and they just brought that over with them. This is the neoclassical cult of state.
So in a sense, you're saying that the actual construction of the city of D.C. is not itself a tool, meaning it's not emanating some sort of mind control because of the way that it's designed, but it's a symbolic a process. Like they created a language in the form of a city to spell out exactly what that city was trying to manifest.
Right. This is the language that they're speaking in. It's not the language of Christianity, I'll tell you that much.
Well, that is for gosh damn sure. So the point being that I want people to get out of that, because it's very difficult because of the way that modern education has basically wiped any pre-modern approach to methodology and science so to our listeners.
Music, especially.
Everything. Yeah, everything. Okay, everything.
During the time of Beethoven, they were teaching music a very different way. They were talking about how music has gender. When's the last time you heard that in a music class, right? They just talk about the basic notes.
Well, nowadays, you'll probably hear that again, but in a completely neoliberalized, safe, and controlled way.
Oh, my God. It's neoliberalism is the satanic inversion of hermeticism.
No argument there, my friend.
Let's go over the hermetic principles real quick. There's seven hermetic principles. Okay.
Sure.
The principle, this is the first one, the principle of mentalism. All is mind. If you want extreme subjectivism, that's the way to go. There's nothing more that you can really say. It describes the whole universe. All is mind, and it's all part of one mind, but that mind can think completely different.
That's Hegel. That's all Hegel. Right, there you go.
Second, this principle of correspondence. As above, so below.
As above, correspondence. So below.
Right, the principle of vibration. Everything moves. Yeah, principle of vibration. Everything moves in waves, and those waves have ups and downs. Right. So these are just basic scientific ideas, but they all add up to a greater picture. The principle of polarity. Everything has a north and a south. Everything has an east and a west. All of that sort of stuff. That includes. Rhythm is part of polarity and vibration. So now these are all building on top of each other. The next one is the principle of rhythm is five, right? The principle of cause and effect. And this one includes retrocausality. Mm-hmm. And then number seven, the principle of gender. Everything is gendered in its own way or not. Everything is gendered. So you're talking about male and female for humans, the different types of minerals and rocks, the different types of notes, everything that was taught
gender just comes out of the principle of polarity, right?
Right.
I'm sure those two things are interrelated.
Principle of polarity and vibration, right? These two things, you know, you have to have one for the other to exist. So it's not necessarily ascribing everything a specific gender, but
it seems like it's just, it's funny because this is, I always push up against it. Anything that seems too objectivist, I always push up against. But I also think what I'm reading here, what you're describing, seems like patterns. It seems totally patternistic in nature. Yeah, it's
right. This goes back to the energy waves.
Yeah,
right. This goes back to the energy waves. So, like, even you know, buying a service from somebody creates a wave, and that wave, you know, continues on in terms of energy in other aspects. So, you know. As we're these energy waves moving outwards and contracting inwards, we don't see that anymore. We're all so focused on the material, we can't understand the actual, the methodology of these things, because we don't talk about things in terms of methodology. We talk about things in terms of materialism.
All right, let's segue into the final part of this here, which is to continue on that note. What do you think practical alchemy and what we've talked about has most to offer anybody who's interested in it? Like, how would you campaign for it or apologize for it? What would be the best way to approach that?
Well, it takes a lot of study, but I think that when you get your feet into practical alchemy, it'll provide the springboard, the jump off point to get into pretty much anything else. Like I've said before, these principles apply universally in a very subjective manner, right? So objective subjectivity, that's what we're going for.
Yeah. Very interesting. So it's kind of what practical alchemy could offer for people is a methodological approach.
Right. You've got the trivium, right? And the quadrivium. These things were part and parcel to alchemy, like the trivium, the salt, sulfur, and mercury of the trivium are grammar, logic, and rhetoric, right?
So the trivium, now what you're saying is grammar, logic, and rhetoric correspond to those functional capacities that salt, mercury, and sulfur have?
Yeah, it's all the same thing. This is why they used it over and over again. And the quadrivium was all of the physical manifestations of the grammar, logic, and rhetoric in terms of numbers. Right. So you had astronomy, you had music, you had all these other things that they would be teaching based off of these original core principles, the salt, sulfur, and mercury. So as you expand outward to the quintessence, like you were talking about last time, the quintessence would be the three and the four, making, you know, sort of like this seven, right? The seven figure is sort of like three and seven are kind of these balances that would be the polarity of it, right?
You mean three and four are the balances for seven. Is that what you're trying to say? Okay,
well,
I understand.
In a way, this is kind of numerology.
Think Fibonacci. I'm thinking Fibonacci right now.
Right. Well, you would be right because, you know, the people who you know, like when you look at platonic solids, you know, and geometric figures that sort of are the most basic thing making up the universe.
I'm sorry, you say platonic solids, like I have to go for it. Buddy, that's my ex-wife.
She is solid and totally platonic.
And we are platonic, my friend. All right, please continue. Just had to take
the platonic solids are the most basic forms that make up the universe. And nobody could really figure out how they could make, you know, these platonic solids make up something like a cloud or all of these other things
forms.
In terms of art.
So right, not elements, forms. Okay.
And it wasn't until recently when this guy's like, well, why don't we go back to what the alchemists were talking about and do things like fractal mathematics? Mm-hmm. And so you use fractal mathematics to take the forms, the idea of the platonic solids, and have them branch out. And so now we have computer graphics, which is all based off of fractal geometry coming from this guy studying alchemy.
Mm. Jesus. Right? All right.
So it's all there. We just got to dig it up.
Yeah, know? It's not discussed. It's discussed in the same like silent circles that you imagine like unbelievable conspiracy theories are being discussed in. You're telling me this is something that if I'm on the computer with you right now looking at the name The Anarchy Bowl, that has to go up there because of a graphics interface. And the guy who was involved in that was looking into alchemy for inspiration. And that's
a little
not
different
about.
Than that. Okay. I'm talking mostly about like CGI, like have you ever messed around with Blender before?
Not well, no, but yes, I know what it is.
Yeah. Well, the fractal geometry goes into that immensely, right? So when they're talking about making, you know, an algorithm to, break an object into many different pieces, it would use that fractal geometry to get that done. And the original fractal geometries were used in the triangles and the quadrants and stuff that made the original, you know, computer graphics work on that level, right?
Crazy. It's so weird.
So, I mean, we're all sitting on the shoulders of giant alchemists, only we've never heard their names and we don't know what they're talking about, because why would they teach this stuff in school? They don't even teach the trivium in school.
They actually don't even teach you how to pay your taxes in school. So they don't even teach you the things that they should be teaching you. So, yeah, you're not going to learn anything in school.
Right, but that's what I'm talking about. It's the satanic inversion of Hermeticism. Hermeticism is the love of knowledge. It's the feel knowledge vibrating through you.
Mm-hmm. Modern education is obscurantist because Satan is behind it. I agree.
Well, no. I mean, satanic in terms of inversion.
Also, literally, it's probably satanic in that it's dulling people down and turning them into gray objects that do nothing but sin and...
yell at each other about what they should be sinning about.
That's my take, at least.
Well, here's another aspect. You know, the great cathedrals of Europe were built by alchemists. These people.
Yeah, no,
like,
it doesn't surprise me when you're telling me that geometric principles and none of that surprises me now, because all the people involved in those things were the guys with the skills to build those beautiful buildings, no doubt.
Right, and so that's why the Freemasons chose that title. Right, because they're thinking about these perfect geometric structures called cathedrals that would have such beautiful notes coming out of them that would resonate with the entire building. This is all about the musical properties of you know, stuff, wood, stone. These things have, and you know, they, everybody talks about, you know, Tesla's vibration weapon that can cause an earthquake. All he was doing was trying to find the resonant frequency of materials. And the alchemists had figured out that everything has resonant frequency, you know, 1,000 years before that. Mm-hmm. So we just have to keep going over the same shit over and over again, because it just continually becomes obscure. And I think that has a lot to do with the difference between magic and tradition, right? With magic, you're trying something new. With tradition, you're just going back over the same ground that's already been passed over before. So we need to have, yeah, I mean, like when you're doing a magic spell, it's for something. It's for a definite goal. It's something that's new. But you go to a church service, you're going over the same ground. There's nothing necessarily wrong with that. But it's important to identify the difference.
Right. I understand what you mean. Yeah, that's true. That is the difference between, one difference between science and religion certainly is one has to be novel by its very nature, and one has to remain the same by its very nature.
Right. And I think you can balance those two forces out in your own life to have a better experience.
Oh yeah, no doubt. Isn't that another, not a principle, but seems like a preoccupation with alchemists is balance.
Right. It's breaking down the constituent parts so that the new medicine or the new piece of information that you're adding into it can be within that balanced environment. So the spagyra, you know, according to science, does nothing. It's just ashes, you know, alcohol and some oil.
Well, that's crazy because it's literally certain materials, atomic materials. Right. There's certain materials in the ash.
Well, it's not just that. There's a essence that's passed on with those materials that science doesn't even care to look at, right? They don't look at the electromagnetic properties of the thing. These are very certain atoms. We don't have to think about the electromagnetic properties. We don't have to worry about whether or not the signal coming from these things is different, because that's just not part of medicine.
Right.
So in terms of plant alchemy, doing the process of creating this new spagyra is creating the plant stone. Now the plant stone is like the philosopher's stone for minerals, only it's for plants. And the plant stone is where you've reverberated, right? Back to the principle of vibration. You've reverberated this mixture of salt, sulfur, and mercury from that plant enough to where you've created a stone out of it that can be melted onto a substance, sort of a waxy substance. Ah, and once you've reverberated it to that level, you can mix in another plant with a little bit more alcohol, and then all of the properties of that plant immediately come out into that liquid. And this is the plant stone. This is important for understanding the philosopher's stone.
Wow, because so that's literally the transmutative process. That's how it goes through.
Exactly. And you have to be able, one of the most useful tool to the alchemist was the pelican. And the pelican was a reverberator flask. Have you ever seen the picture of the pelican feeding its young out of the heart of the blood of its heart?
No.
That was a symbol for Christianity. You've got a big cross in the background. You've got the pelican feeding its young out of the blood of its heart.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
Right? Well, that the pelican was the same idea in alchemy. The pelican had these two arms that would reverberate the fluid over and over again, and it would take on a higher vibration. And so this plant stone would be used by the alchemist to immediately produce medicines from any plant that you come into contact with. But I mean, it's once you've discovered the plant stone, you can move on to the other kingdoms and you can create the animal stone, you know?
So now I want to get weird very briefly before we end this. Now I'm curious. So there's if the philosopher's stone is a principle as much as it is an actual substance, meaning there's a transmutative thing which transmutes anything into anything else, and that has to exist in every realm, I don't know what you'd say, in every realm of something, then there has to be, perhaps, I would at least wonder, is there a concept of a philosopher's stone in something like sociology or opinion making? Is there a search to find? Yeah, tell me.
Rhetoricians have been doing that for centuries.
Please tell me what the rhetorician's philosopher's stone is like. What would that look like? Do you know anything about the search for something like that? Because that's where I would be very interested.
You've got animal magnetism, you know, about hypnosis.
Oh my God. So yeah, I mean, that's like that, I suppose, right? Yeah.
Right? It exists. Yeah. Like, these things exist on every level of reality. And you know, a lot of people try to find them within the astral realm and then bring that stuff
down. Dude, it is hypnotism, isn't it? You're kind of blowing my mind a little bit now. It really would be hypnotism.
Well, that's what they use for everything. If they really want to convince you, they start delving into the hypnotic language and they start using NLP, which is a little bit of lighter form of hypnosis, but they're trying to get you in the beta wave mindset.
Yeah.
Alpha wave mindset.
Maybe they do things
scrape
like
scrape off those layers of resistance using
impossible
words.
Impossible to discern one human face from another, perhaps. Maybe impossible to discern human beings' motives from one another by convincing them that every human being around you is a threat for some reason, perhaps. Things like that maybe would be hypnotic and would move
Bingo.
People to change their behavior and something like that, perhaps. Paul, would that sound like that? Maybe.
Right. But you see, this whole thing has been turned into, like, they figured out, yes, there is a science to convincing people. And that's publicity. That's PR. That's what they started to do. I mean, the nephew of Freud, he did it. And then everybody since has been copying that guy and honing his craft to create, you know, the human rhetoric stone, which is, we get to jam anything we want to into you because we are the establishment.
No. Man, that's an interesting way of, you know, you hear the term cathedral a lot coming out of the neo-reactionary crowd.
Cathedral.
Throne, right? Is that a throne?
No, the cathedrals were made by the alchemists.
No, I just meant the word. Structure. Oh, I meant the word. What it meant. But yeah. No, you're
right. It's the same thing. Like, everybody rallied around the cathedral in these small towns. It was a major point of control. Right? Because once you had that cathedral, everybody, you know, they saw the glimpse of the divine. That's what a cathedral is. And that's why everybody's so hooked on this idea that they have to be into the cathedral. Everybody knows exactly what they can and cannot say. Mm-hmm. And nobody had to tell them.
Right. Yeah, it's built in.
Mm. Right. It's all in the groundwork.
I think I'm going to look into rhetoric a little bit, because I think I want to try and get to that social philosopher's stone. I could be good at that.
Look into hypnosis, man. Start with the animal magnetism, because that's basically what he's... I mean, animal magnetism and alchemy go hand in hand. That's what he was basing his work on.
None
of the people are like,
hey,
this actually work.
When you say animal magnetism, I'm drawn to thinking about like big body beefcakes on the beach, and that's not what you mean. So what,
no,
what is that?
No, okay. So the first hypnosis was this guy who started seeing things like, what's it called? You know, where you can put an animal to sleep by flipping it on its back. Immobility.
Like a chicken or something, whatever. Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
And so he started realizing that there's some sort of mental property that he can tap into that could create an animal magnetic frequency in humans as well. So he started doing hypnosis and started doing the tonic immobility to people.
Oh, magnetism meaning frequency, not like attraction,
right.
Not like social attraction, but like a physical one. Okay.
Like you're speaking physical frequencies that cause a reaction in another person's brain,
right,
or in the brains of animals. And so the only thing he could come up with was magnetism, because that was a big rage in the late
1800s. Trying to do to my listeners, dude. I'm trying to get my listeners to trying to philosopher stone my listeners into coming to Childeberg.
Well, I mean, you got to use some animal magnetism on them. And if that doesn't work, you start to use some meat products, right? The meat products, you get them out
Whip
of their
that
holes.
Meat out. Yeah, no doubt. Right. 100%. Well, food. I mean, if you've ever been to a real high quality restaurant where you're eating alone in a controlled place, truly hypnotic can be. You can truly convince anybody over a good meal. which you'll find at Childeberg.
If you've got the right atmosphere, if you've got the right feelings and the sensation, everything just sort of starts clicking into place.
Maybe even we could do something like create, maybe we don't even need the physical atmosphere, and maybe I could just mention to you, you know, the delicious smell of a grilling piece of meat and how hungry you get, even from just imagining
you're
that.
You're making me hungry right now.
Yeah, and knowing that when you hear that sizzle and that savory smell of burnt flesh that you can just sink into your mouth with the pop of the tomato and the ketchup on the burger and the bun and the French fries.
I'm going to Childeberg.
See, and you want to come to Childeberg because even better than that is you know that there's going to be delicious, sweet, homemade mead there that will just complement that burger so nicely, and there'll be music and friendship there, and you want to come because who wouldn't want to be in an event like something like
that?
Don't
forget the sex. There's going to be lots of free sex everywhere.
Bags,
there's going to be
bags,
free sex hanging. Bags.
Everything. Bags of stuff, dude. Bags of everything. Yeah, and nobody will judge you there, and you want to go there. You want to come to Childeberg. You want to. You want to, listeners.
Yeah. Look, you want to because
I'm trying.
The food, you'll come for the food. You'll stay for the free sex, the bags of free sex.
The bags of free sex that will be given to you upon arrival and demonstration that you will comply with any further order given once you arrive at the place.
Yes, get in the bag for free sex.
Get in that bag for the free sex. That would be great. You and I are standing, holding open a large bag. Get in, free sex. Really?
Free sex.
In there,
right in
all
here.
The way in. Really? You
what
sure?
What did we tell you?
Yeah, I'm telling you. Why would I lie to you? I have this bag here. You thought I brought this bag for no reason? You know, maybe
you smell that meat,
in?
Don't you?
Wouldn't you go
meat
in,
cooking,
listener?
There's free sex in the bag.
When you go in, listener, if the two of us were standing there with an open bag, the smell of meat telling you, hey, there's free sex in that bag, wouldn't you trust us? You'd go in the back. You would. You would go in.
You'll come out changed. You'll come out a new person.
You may not
all
come out at all.
All your problems will melt it away. No.
You may never
you
come, want to come out.
You become one with the universe inside of a bag, which is interesting. I also did research on witchcraft, and they had what was called a witch's bag, a witch's cradle.
Really?
Right, where they would tie a bag up and hoist it up into a tree, and you'd stay in there for like 3 or 4 days.
Who? The victim?
Suspension.
I mean the
well,
Childeberg
the
goer.
The Childeberg goer, right? And the witch would stay up in the tree for 3 days until they would just start tripping out, being locked in a bag for that long.
Well, that's pretty incredible because that's sensory deprivation. Early on, for sure. I mean, that's 100% a way that you'll be able to start tripping out, which you
absolutely
will be able to experience if you get in the bag. Get in the bag.
Get in the bag. Get in the bag.
Well,
I think this is a great episode.
It was probably the best episode that I've ever done on this show, certainly, and one of my favorites that I've done on the overall TLE program. So thank you for coming on. I really appreciate it. I like to learn about really weird stuff.
I can't wait to see the Philosopher's Stone that comes out of the bag after about 3 days strung up in the tree.
Yeah, it's going to smell. I'll tell you that.
It's going to smell like beef.
Really bad. Yeah, it'll smell really bad. Well, tell my listeners where they can find you, what you would like to plug, and anything like that.
Well, I'd love to plug my podcast. I've been off of it for a while because I've been moving. I no longer reside on the East Coast. So
yeah,
screw
hooray.
You guys.
Congratulations. Yeah, no, really, it's the best time in the world to get off the East Coast unless you want to go to Florida.
Right. So I'm going to start it back up, and we're going to have a lot of fun. Just go to Anarchy Ball Podcast,
and
you can get that downloaded on any device you want to. And get
go
in the bag
now and do it, and get in that bag while you do. Yeah, when you're in the bag, you'll probably still have cell phone service for a little while. Listen to his show. Go do it.
Go. So easy.
Right.
So easy.
Ball, I
right.
don't have a way
much.
Of ending this show. Why don't you give the listeners one piece of general piece of advice that they should live by?
Well, if you've made monatomic gold, I would suggest not eating too much of it because people go crazy eating monatomic gold, thinking that they're going to get to the philosopher's stone, or eat too much of it if you want to go crazy and find that philosopher's stone.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen.